Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. Recorded at the University of Minnesota, you are listening to Radio K's Culture Q, the Twin Cities Arts and Culture program providing you the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Matthew Curtis, and thank you for joining us. This week, instead of studying for all those classes we're in, we're taking a break, we're putting our feet up, and we're reading some comics. The colorful, eventful, suspenseful print media that's reflected American culture since the Great Depression. Although our cherished superheroes lost popularity in the middle of the 20th century, blockbuster movies, A-list actors, and special effects have revived the genre in ways that couldn't have possibly been conceived in the 1930s. So let's dive into the action. It all starts right now on Radio K's Culture Q. There's nothing particularly manly about reading comics, playing board games, or gasping just a little too audibly when someone plays the Black Lotus in Magic cards. Yet, nerd culture feels like it's always been a guy's club. However, producer Amy Freeman dives into a history that tells a very different story. Not only have comics not always been a guy's thing, but Freeman interviews one all-girls comic club to see how women are fighting today's nerd misogyny with a pow.
Hiding out on the periphery of Roseville is Minnesota's largest comic book store, Source Comics and Games. It's huge, like the Walmart of nerd stuff. And if you walk all the way to the back of the store, there's a game room with tables set up where 15 to 20 people are playing magic cards and board games.
A tap or two for dragon fodder.
And every single one of them is a man.
Why do you think there are no girls in this room right now? No women at all?
I think it's just the kind of things that guys are into.
It's a good question. It's been around for a long time.
I don't understand why that's the case with board games, because it is a gender neutral thing.
I don't really know. Just it's been like that for as long as I really can remember.
There was some sort of weird consensus. Nerd culture, they said, is a guy thing because it's always been a guy thing.
That sums it up entirely, that it is a guy thing.
But here's the thing. That's not true.
Something like the surveys after World War II in the mid-40s suggested that anywhere between 80 to 90% of all kids, regardless of gender, were avid comics readers.
This is Fred Van Lente, author of The Comic Book History of Comics. He says that as television became more popular, everything sort of died off, except for the superhero.
And it's no coincidence that superheroes who tend to solve problems by punching them in the face, became very popular during World War II, when everybody was very anxious and it was a very violent period, and people were really scared, and aggression was sort of the theme of the day, right?
So at this point, it's a guy thing, but not quite a nerd thing.
You had soldiers read a lot of comics, and a lot of these soldiers were, just coming out of high school. They were essentially kids, many of them.
If you wanted to read a comic book, you would buy it from a newsstand, either on the street or maybe in a convenience store. But in the 1970s, this entire system changed. Demand for comics was on the decline, and they receded into specialty stores, where only the most dedicated would go to seek them out. The comic book nerd.
Comic sales were tanking along with Newsweek and the New York Times and any other periodical that was on the newsstand. And it was only all the nerds, the hardcore fans, who preserved the comic and moved them off the newsstand into specialty stores in the mid-70s. It really kept comics alive. There really wouldn't be comics today if there weren't for nerds.
And now, of course, nerds are cool, which means that comic books are cool. More and more people are getting into them, including women. And while the guys I talked to told me that things were getting a lot better, women told a very different story.
Everyone is still arguing about the new Avengers movie because of the roles that Black Widow did or did not play in that movie. And she's on none of the merchandise.
This is Lisa Olson. She works at that comic book and game store from earlier. She's referring to Joss Whedon's new Avengers movie, Age of Ultron, and more specifically, the most well-known female Avenger, Black Widow, played by Scarlett Johansson.
Hey, big guy. Sun's getting real low.
She had the third most screen time of all the Avengers in the movie, and yet of the 56 items of Ultron merchandise, she only appears on a tote bag, a mouse pad, a mug, and one t-shirt.
I read an article about an internal memo that went around Disney.
Okay, remember that back in 2009, Disney bought Marvel.
About the fact that they feel very comfortable that they have a lockdown on the girl princess market that they're trying to sell stuff to, and they're very comfortable with their sales, so they feel like they don't need to make any superhero things targeted at girls, and they don't want to alienate any young boys by putting girls on their stuff.
Okay, did you catch that? That was a lot. So Disney now owns two markets, and they think that these markets are separate. Disney Princess and Superhero. Girls and boys. This works, they think. Don't shake things up. But Olsen sees something very different happening in her store.
We see kids in here all the time who are doing cosplay who come as Princess Batman or Princess Superman. And you ask them about it, and they'll just be like, well, I'm Batman. And you ask them why they're wearing a skirt then, just, well, I'm Princess Batman. And there is absolutely no disconnect for them in their head, and they just combine the things that they like.
There's this sort of illusion that all of these choices that Marvel and the comic book industry make are based in financial logic. But from what Olsen is telling, the numbers don't support this. Their cold financial reasoning is really just good old-fashioned sexism.
The new Thor, with Thor as a woman, up until at least an issue or two ago, has been outselling the previous Thor by a wide margin.
By 30%.
If there was some excitement around the new storyline simply because Thor was a woman and that was different, that sort of thing tends to drop off after a couple issues. But Thor has maintained its popularity.
And so where does that leave women? The numbers are there. Women are ready to love comics. But are comics ready to love them?
Nerd culture can be a little non-welcoming for women sometimes. And
this is Julia Walchuk, a senior at the University of Minnesota. She reviews comics and co-founded a girls-only comic book club that meets every week at the Kitty Cat Club in Dinkytown.
In my experience in other comic book clubs, there's always been like one or two guys who just try to dominate the conversation. Just something about the way that girls have been brought up, girls are raised, it's hard to like take that conversation back. And so we really wanted this space to be a space where girls could be comfortable talking, girls could be comfortable like interjecting and sharing their thoughts.
At the back of the Kitty Cat Club, there are about 10 girls gathered around in a cozy circle. Each has a hefty pile of comics sitting in front of them. Everything they've read from the week before. This group is everything that the numbers don't show. Yes, 46% of comic book fans are female, but listen to the stories of this 46%.
I think it was before you came in. I was talking about how guys don't have to prove it.
This is Katie.
It's so upsetting. I know people who have comics in their Twitter username and have not picked up a comic this year. And nobody calls them fake geek boys, because who would do that? That's not a thing.
They talked about sexual harassment, how at comic cons everywhere in 2014 were putting up signs that actually had to state, cosplay is not consent.
And then you get creators, and I know it's been like a year and a half, but creators who say things like, women only come to comic cons to dress like sluts and get attention. Okay. And you're like, stop drawing us like that, and I won't dress like that, man.
Later, Julia Walchuk, the founder of the club, told me about her favorite comic book character. But it was more like she was describing her own life.
Carrie Kelly is like this really spunky girl who like makes herself a costume, starts following Batman around, and he kind of ignores her, but then she saves his life, and he's like, oh, you are really cool. Okay, like, you can be my Robin now, so... She's my favorite.
But until all of the Batmans of the world come to their super senses, the sign outside of this club will continue to read, "No Boys Allowed." For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
When it comes to superheroes, America is in love. But as movies like The Avengers: Age of Ultron pull in 85 million on opening day, are the sources, actual physical comics, benefiting? Are people still willing to put in the time and money into an aging American pastime? Aaron Bolton has more.
The modern comic book superhero we know and love today was born in 1933 in Cleveland, Ohio. Two high school boys, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, captivated America with Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet.
More power. It would be 19 years before America would get to see George Reeves put on the spandex and fly through the clouds.
Up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman. Strange visitor from another...
Since TV's first encounter with the adventures of Superman, America's beloved characters like Batman, the Hulk, and Spider-Man have all left the page through TV shows, movies, and now digital comics. But have they left the paperback comic behind?
Once you create an excitement and a media that provides strong entertainment, people want that to continue. And comics are great for that because they're serial in nature.
This is Bob Bertelsen.
I'm the owner of Source Comics and Games.
And Bertelsen is excited about what the future holds for his store.
We've had some hard times, yeah. But we're better. We're in a high point now. Golden ages, almost.
As everything physical moves to the digital format, you would think physical comics are a thing of the past. But to the contrary, movies in the online world are generating interest.
I mean, I like to think that the golden age is continually coming.
Comic book writer and artist Xander Cannon agrees that movies, TV shows, and digital comic book services like Marvel Unlimited aren't currently damaging print sales.
Digital comics are really taking away from the print sales, and it's like, I don't know the numbers, but I don't see that happening. And I think a lot of good retailers don't see that happening either, because they see that people are getting excited about it. And then they come in and it's like, oh, I've read all this stuff piecemeal sort of on the internet. And now I can get this beautiful hardbound book. You know, have the internet be your cheerleader.
But Cannon believes the future of the paperback comic is a little bit uncertain.
I don't know about takeover, but I mean, it's making a huge dent, and print is going to sort of have to make some difficult choices in the next 10 years or so.
Cannon got his start in 93 and has been drawing and creating all over the industry, from comic giant DC to more small press like New England Comics. But now he works on mostly creator-owned projects.
Currently working on the project Kaiju Max,
which has Cannon making the decision for himself. Print or digital?
And the last book that we did, it's on digital and print now, but when it was originally being serialized, it was just digital. And that was sort of an experiment on our part to sort of say, like, if we don't have to compete with a print version of ourselves, let's see what we can price this at. We can have a lot of pages for not very much money and sort of see how that works. And
it worked well. Cannon said Heck was successful in its digital form.
Let's get into people's hands. That's the most important thing. And I think that really helps. I think
Bertelsen, who I haven't forgotten about, agrees.
Once you create an excitement, people want that to continue.
But he says getting comics into people's lives in any form, not just your generic superhero, is what's bringing people through his doors.
There's something for everybody. In the old days, it was really superheroes or comedy books or horror books. And now there's just so much more.
When you step through the doors of the source, it can be overwhelming, the variety to choose from. I mean, you got your typical superheroes over here, but then there's fantasy, sci-fi, romance, alternative, manga, westerns, genres that blend a few of those together, and they're all staring right back at you.
I mean, I got 600 titles on my shelves, 600.
And it's his staff's job to guide you through the shelves lined with thousands of paperbacks. And it's most definitely a nerd's paradise. But the plethora of choices weren't always there, and comics in America weren't always this diverse.
I mean, people had always sort of pointed at Japan, where it's just like, oh my gosh, there's comics about this, there's comics about golf, and there's comics about housewives, and there's comics about, you know, fantasy, but then there's also comics about sort of mundane things. And now, just many, many decades later, it's like, that's now what's happening with us.
What's your outlook for the future? I mean, on your side of things?
I mean, I hope that they become more diverse, and so that we can really look at comics as sort of this wellspring of ideas, because it's so cheap and so accessible to make a comic. You don't have to spend $140 million to make your sci-fi epic. You can do it by yourself in a basement with a pen and paper.
The tides are surely changing in the world of what used to be only vibrant spandex and hidden identities. Both Bertelsen and Cannon can agree. Their careers are benefiting from the current change.
I like to think that my career is heading upward, and so I'm very optimistic. Maybe if my career was sort of in a downward trajectory, I might not quite be so enthusiastic.
For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing.
Hi, I'm Matthew Kudis, and you're listening to Culture Q on Radio K, and I'm here to present this week's weekly release spotlight, a new album that we at Radio K highlight every week in partnership with Electric Fetus. This week's record is Ava Luna's third LP, Infinite House, released on Western Vinyl. To read a full review of the album by copywriter Sam Siegel and download a free track from the album, just log on to RadioK.org. Right now, this is Steve Polyester by Ava Luna on Radio K's Culture Q.
I was lying in the shade where the dandelions grow. And asphalt is hollow, and the rocks are broken down. Not so popular part of town. I'd heard he was witty. We've seen signs of it all around the city. The people said,
do 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 do.
He's a landscape. He's like a ruby lined in gold.
Like a cockroach.
He smells good.
These notions were hazy, ordinary, a bit lazy. I was swinging on a branch outside, catching a ride when my resolve swelled. I will find him, I will. I have momentum still. Then I fell into an anthill. Fell into an anthill. And the people said, I will find him, I will. I have momentum still. Then I fell into an anthill. And all the people said, they carried me back to my doorstep. The sand was in my eyes, but I saw him. I saw him, a friend, a friend. I found in him a friend, a friend. And he went by the name of Steve Polyester. He said, I am a landscape. Yeah, I'm a ruby lined in gold. Yeah, shaped like a cockroach. I smell good. And the people say, and he said, I am a landscape. I am a ruby lined in gold, shaped like a cockroach. I smell good. He was a landscape nonetheless. He would escape. Never be the same. Why do you have to go? Who is there to blame? And the people said, saw him a friend of friend, saw him a friend of friend, in him a friend of friend. Went farther than he ought to have gone. He went farther and farther until
Once again, that was Steve Polyester by Ava Luna from their latest LP, Infinite House, on Radio K's Culture Q. You can check out a full review of the album written by copywriter Sam Siegel, as well as download a free track on RadioK.org. If you were to ask someone which superheroes first come to mind, I'm guessing Batman would be either first or second on that list. Billionaire Bruce Wayne's alter ego has been reinterpreted countless times in print, television, and movies. But how does Batman transfer from page to stage? We'll find out with former producer and host, Mitch Skinner.
Eight major motion pictures, six animated series, including the upcoming Beware the Batman, and a host of comic book lines. There has been no shortage of Batman in media. Now you can add live theater to the mix.
I feel like we cherry-picked from the source material, because, like I said, there is such a wealth that we can pick what we think is most suited to a live show.
Jack Walker plays Batman and his alter ego Bruce Wayne in the ongoing Batman Live production. The show is sort of a combination between Cirque du Soleil and a motion comic, and it features a familiar story centered on Robin's origin. It started out in Manchester, now it's come to the States, including a run at the XL Energy Center from September 13th through the 16th. It's an all-ages show, but Walker says Batman Live does try to inject some of the darker tones of the character into the production.
So that stuff is definitely there, and I feel like we commit to each thing that we do, so when we do go a bit dark, we go there, but it's light enough, it's funny enough, and it keeps moving at a fast enough pace for it to not be sort of too dark for families.
Batman Live depicts the murders of Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson's parents, as well as the anger they both harbored that led to the creation of their alter egos, Batman and Robin. But the Batman and Batman Live might not be as dark as comic book fans have come to expect from the beloved character.
Batman is in fact one of my favorite characters.
This is Roy T. Cook, an associate philosophy professor at the University of Minnesota and a comic book expert.
Human or not, humanity is not the adjective I would use to describe him. Batman is deeply, deeply disturbed. He's mentally ill. In fact, Grant Morrison, in his recent run on Batman, announced at the beginning that his goal was to put the pieces of Batman's life back together and solve some of his mental issues and make him a more complete, happy character. And Grant Morrison admitted at the end that he failed to do this, that this couldn't be done with Batman, that he was just inherently a damaged person, and that was part of his character.
In the comics, the damage goes beyond Bruce Wayne's unresolved anger over the murder of his parents, according to Cook. He says the character has even deeper psychological demons.
Batman has something like a multiple personality disorder. It's not quite the textbook version of that, but there's certain senses in which Batman and Bruce Wayne are distinct personalities, not just personas that he puts on to fool people so other characters in the comic won't figure out that one is the other, but that these are actually two different parts of that single human being's psychology. And in fact, there's further evidence that it may be Batman that's the more real.
Cook admits that there is no definitive version of Batman. However, after The Dark Knight's recent success on the big screen, fans are sure to compare the different takes on the character. Jack Walker thinks his Batman can hold his own.
Inevitably, it's going to be compared to the various different permutations, but I think it's strong enough to stand alone. And I know it's not long after the last Nolan movie, so there is that still fresh in the mind, but it's so totally different that I think that you'd struggle to draw too many parallels. So, yeah, it's its own thing.
And Batman Live is certainly appropriate for children. Deaths happen out of sight, and psychological issues are really only hinted at throughout the show. But it's certainly not as silly or campy as the 1960s television show or some of the Batman films.
Let's take some ice!
Even still, Roy Cook says Batman fans want to see the very dark depiction of the character in media.
Post Alan Moore, Grant Morrison, Frank Miller stories, that's what people want, or at least what they think they want. And I think that's likely to hurt the response of this production, or response to this production, amongst adults. Nevertheless, adults are going to go, because kids are likely going to love it. And the adults are going to be dragged along with the kids. So that doesn't necessarily mean it won't be a hit, and that also doesn't necessarily mean that along the road, somewhere in the future, it won't be looked back upon as an important contribution to the Batman mythos. But my suspicion is, for the time being, the adults who see it are going to think of it as something that they viewed so that their kids could see it.
Jack Walker says that so far, audiences have reacted positively to Batman Live, though he didn't say whether or not there was a divide between children and adults.
They loved it. I mean, you know, you can only go off the sort of vocal response, and from my experience of it, they've really gone for it. All the right moments, they laugh at the right jokes, they whoop and cheer at the more exciting moments, the bits where the characters come out. And I think partly because of how tightly it's run, it doesn't feel like you ever get respite from it. You're just in it, and I think it's engaging from start to finish, providing nothing goes wrong, you know.
All right, so I think I only have one question left in mind. If ticket cost wasn't an issue, would you go see Batman Live?
Yes.
For what reason?
Just to see how it turns out, to see how some of these speculations that I've just made play out, to see Batman, you know, live.
I am vengeance. I am the night. I am Batman.
For Culture Q, I'm Mitch Skinner.
You've been listening to Radio K's Culture Q, airing every Sunday at 6 p.m, bringing you all the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. Tonight you heard the voices of Aaron Bolton, Amy Friedman, and Matthew Curtis. Our producers are Amy Friedman, Max Fuller, and Aaron Bolton. Our culture coach is Sarah Lamanchak, and I am your host and managing editor, Matthew Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, PRX, and iTunes. You can join us on Facebook, just search Culture Q. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. See you next Sunday at 6 p.m, and thank you for listening.